Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And Christy, on our show today, we'll be talking with Yosef Abramowitz, president of Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health, something that I became acutely aware of when I was visiting the south of Israel and I saw the solar field he developed. Amazing.
A remarkable man. I'm looking forward to this conversation. But first, Adam, we have some research that matters, and we've got some good ones today. We're going to talk about sleep and how lack of sleep might mess with your emotions.
Why do you say that, Christy? Maybe I didn't get enough sleep.
I know. Also, why do I yell in the mornings?
We'll find out. We're also going to talk about, Christy and I were trained as family physicians with the scope of practice, what we do. Are the newer family doctors, do they share our scope of practice, or are they even better?
I'm very interested in that topic. And then we're going to talk about once-a-week diabetes medicine that shows a lot of promise in terms of safety and effectiveness compared with some of the other medicines.
Let's dive right in, Christy, and talk about sleep and emotions. And this was some research that was in the Journal of Neuroscience. And they were looking at what is it like when you just miss a single night of sleep, which happens to doctors pretty frequently.
Right. And the bad news, too, that 30% of American adults get less than 6 hours of sleep per night, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. So this is really common that most, or at least 30%, a large portion of adults don't get very much sleep at night. And this is a study looking at then what happens to your ability to control your emotions the next day.
And what they actually were looking at is only 18 adults, but sometimes you can do really good research with not a lot of subjects. They were kept awake all night, and then they did a couple different tests while they were being kind of studied with their brain waves. They were looking after a night of good night's sleep, and then a second night when they were kind of kept up all night, and they had different sorts of tests they had to do, and it was to see what would happen if they were like presented with a kind of a neutral emotion, a positive emotion or a negative emotion, and how people then looked at it. And unfortunately, what they found is on, you know, the good night's rest, most people could do pretty much all the different tests. But on a bad night's rest, the negative emotions would, as expected, kind of cause you to get aroused and upset. But if you had not gotten good sleep, even the neutral emotions cause you to arouse and get upset, which really suggests that, you know, we can get really distracted by just things that are neutral because we misinterpret what they may mean. I don't know if that's ever happened with you,
Christy. Oh, of course. I was just explaining the other day to my children, like, the mornings are a hard time for me. Like, I need us to, like, try better. So, because I don't want to be angry mommy in the morning. But what this suggests to me is that it's another reason why we all need to really focus on getting more sleep. Okay. Point A or point one, whatever. Number two, or B, is that we really can add that extra layer of regulation if you are tired, to know that, like, this might be something where I'm feeling angry or I'm responding in a way that's out of character, but it may be related to sleep, and I need to have that extra guard so that you're not angry mommy, or, you know, flying off the handle being angry at something that's not actually, you know, it's really a neutral kind of a situation anyway.
Right.
We want to have positive environments in our workplace, at our home.
When I haven't been sleeping all night, what do you want to have for dinner tonight? I'm like, why do you say that? But the problem is it's not just the way we process it. It also contributes to poor judgment and probably anxiety. And this begins to help us understand you don't really make up for that the next night because you reacted that day. So it's really important, and we're undervaluing it. But now you hear Christy and I talking about it a lot more. We're excited. What about our very next research that matters, Christy?
Well, this is especially
about family physicians and training, something near and dear to your heart.
Yes, especially important to me. As you know, I direct a residency training program for physicians in family medicine, and Adam is a very important faculty member in that as well. But this is looking at the scope of practice, meaning what doctors do when they finish their training in family medicine. Do they just do outpatient care or see just adults or children, or do they do prenatal care, OB, hospital care? And it turns out that Graduating family medicine residents have indicated they want to provide a broader scope of practice than what is currently found in family medicine across the nation.
Yeah, these family doctors included over 3,000 people who were just getting their board certification, pretty much right out of residency, and then 10,000 people who had been out in practice for at least 6, 7, 8 years who were getting recertified. And they found that those who were just coming out are practicing a broader scope of practice, which is what most people want. Now, I think this could be that they were trained to do that. So when they first go out into practice, they're doing that. But it's kind of promising. It's like saying, this is important and we want to do what we're trained to do.
Well, and also there are so many communities in our nation that don't have primary care doctors and don't have specialists to go to. And so having really well-trained, adaptable family doctors to care for that community is important as a part of improving health in our nation.
And how do our residents do, Christy?
Well, over the last 3 or 4 years, we have about 72% of our graduates who do prenatal care, and 40% of them do deliver. Our family doctor residents deliver babies, 40% of them. About 80% of them do hospital care in addition to their outpatient primary care. And the vast majority of our graduates do some sort of underserved care, meaning taking care of vulnerable populations at a health department or critical access hospital or a community health center or just in a clinic that sees a lot of underserved patients.
And I would imagine that most of our listeners really appreciate having a physician, whether it's a family physician, an internist, a primary care physician, who can take care of most of their needs. It would be a little frustrating for me if the moment I go to my primary care doctor and I have a back problem, if I got referred to an orthopedist or I have a skin problem, I go to the dermatologist, they farm me out everywhere. I do think it's important to know your limits, but to be able to take care of most things that come to you, that's the type of doctor I want to have for myself. I think the American public wants as well.
I would agree.
Our next Research That Matters, Christy, is about these new class of diabetes medications called GLP-1RAs. That's a fancy sort of name for once-a-week diabetes medications that are new in a lot of patients, and doctors who take care of people with diabetes or have diabetes probably aren't quite as familiar with them.
So this was a study that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine looking at these medications that are once a week compared in context with other medications. And really, they looked at 34 trials. So one of those where they pooled the data of lots of different studies that included over 21,000 participants taking one of their five different brand names of these class of drugs, GLP-1RAs. It's hard to say.
It is hard to say, and you can't say it five times real fast. But what we can say is three of these are on the market, two are in development, and there's not a whole lot of difference in terms of their kind of safety and effectiveness. There may be some small differences, and you can talk with your doctor about them. These are not inexpensive medications for a lot of people, certainly if one has insurance and one can afford it. As with many of the diabetes medications, diabetes itself can be an expensive illness to have, but it certainly gives us some pause to understand them better, and I think we're all going to be a little bit more familiar in using these medications.
Particularly if your diabetes is not well controlled, then that would be a perfect situation to mention to your doctor, hey, there are these new medications. Does that apply to me, and does that fit in to my future plan? Because, you know, they're new enough that your doctor may not have a lot of experience with them, and it may require the patient to ask some questions to make sure that you're thinking about all the options.
You know, Christy, the last thing I just want to mention is Research That Matters is not really a research article, but it was something that was in the news about research. It was in the Centers for Disease Control, and it had to do with the fact some criticism that the Centers for Disease Control and the executive director, the director of the CDC, is undergoing for not speaking out about gun violence in the last few years. And I thought about that, and I understand the CDC had been kind of threatened by Congress in the past for the research they had done on gun prevention violence. But I was actually surprised to see that they have spoken out against so many things. And they're such a highly respected agency in the American public. And here, one of the most important issues of our day, people that do get killed from gun-related violence, they really haven't spoken out on it in the last few years. And I found that a little disappointing, frankly.
Well, it is. It's confusing. And I would love to have a conversation so that we could better understand what goes into making those statements. But it does seem unusual that it's an area for the CDC where they're doing real research and they're involved in it, that the person in charge wouldn't speak out about it one way or another. I imagine there are a lot of different pressures and political elements that go into that. But it does seem our responsibility to speak up.
Well, I'm hoping that there will be more research. The CDC will sponsor and get involved and engaged. We know that cars and motor vehicle laws were changed, and over 10 years in the 2000s, motor vehicle deaths went down by 25%. This impact can be had. We can find common ground. It's important to have leadership. Well, that'll conclude, though, Christy, the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Yosef Abramowitz, president of Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we are able to have a unique conversation with Yosef Abramowitz, president of Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health.
I am so looking forward to this conversation. Mr. Abramowitz, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Your extensive work in solar energy around the globe has made people call you Captain Sunshine. Could you describe for our listeners how you became involved in solar energy in the industry and in activism?
Well, I have always been active in social and political causes and certainly cared about the environment. My wife and I moved with our 5 kids to a small agricultural community in the south of Israel, Kibbutz Keturah, and it was really hot and sunny. And I just said to myself, oh, I'm sure the whole place works on solar power. And they're like, nope, nothing going on here. And I was like, that's impossible. It's, you know, third most extreme desert in the world. I'm sure something's going on. And like, nope, nothing even in the region. And I was like, I know Israel's a world leader in something to do with solar and technology. They essentially said the magic word, which is, well, no one's crazy enough to take on the bureaucracy and the politics and the government. And that's when I said to my wife, you know, I'm going to do it, and formed a partnership with Kibbutz Keturah and another partner in New York, David Rosenblatt. It just seemed very obvious. This was back in 2006, and I think the missing ingredient in Israel up until then was really a sense of mission and a naivete that would be needed to go and fight the dragons. And luckily, we won. And we built the solar industry in Israel together.
Yossi, I met you a year ago when I went on the Israel bike ride and visited this kibbutz. And I must say, it had been my second year on the ride, but I had never actually seen the solar field there. And I was blown away as I went to see a solar field. Now, wondering if that's kind of a universally experience that people have when they first see solar fields. Can you describe to us maybe the first time you saw a solar field and what that felt like and how you made a connection between thoughts intellectually, but how it feels in the heart?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, I've seen pictures of solar fields, but the first solar field I ever walked through the way you did was in Abu Dhabi. A wonderful young group called Environmina built a 10-megawatt field, and I was in Abu Dhabi for business reasons, and they offered to give me a tour, and I jumped at it, and it was great and it was beautiful. The field in the south of Israel is so beautiful and well done because you have the starkness and the beauty of the desert, and then then it's a sea of blue. It's almost like a pond stretches out, and the palm trees then in the background. And so I think the contrast, also the contrast between old and new. I mean, the desert is forever, and then all of a sudden something, you know, gleaming and modern and something that represents hope is able to coexist and stand and power, an ancient land. And I think all those forces together, you know, whenever you see life amid, you know, extreme desert, whether it's a plant or a solar field, you know, my heart does beat faster.
Well, we definitely, thinking about hope, want to talk about your work and your company and your work worldwide. But this topic today is about solar energy and health. And although we can make a lot of assumptions and leaps of the relationship between the two, I'd love to hear from your perspective how solar energy or renewable energy in general is related to human health.
Well, true in Israel is also true worldwide. And where you have power plants that burn fossil fuels, the asthma, particularly in children, in a pretty wide perimeter, you know, around, increases. In Israel, the asthma in kids doubles every 10 years around our conventional power plant. And that's awful, both on a human level and there's a cost to society as well. I think the unspoken factor that got the entire world to agree to the climate deal in Paris is that the Chinese, who were really holding out during these negotiations to the very end, had to give in. Why? Because that week in Beijing, all the schools were closed, businesses were closed, people physically couldn't breathe. And so we got to stop burning fossil fuels, not only because of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, but also because of pollution.
You know, you co-founded the Arva Power Company, which is a solar energy company. Tell us a little bit about the Arva Power Company, its goals, and how you partner with surrounding communities and the Bedouin population in the south of Israel, and how that works out.
We're an energy island here because we're in a pretty tough neighborhood, and our grids aren't interconnected. So being an energy island means that you're vulnerable and that you have to supply your own power. In the south of Israel, 60% of the country is desert, and there are these agricultural-based communities spread throughout the south and along the borders. And so these are communities of purpose. Many of them are still very socialist internally in terms of shared work, same salaries, one bank account. And we very much wanted to be able to support value-based communities in the periphery. We always said from the get-go that if there are going to be benefits to the south of Israel, solar benefits, that those should be shared equally, whether you're Muslim or Jew. And we're still waging that battle, and I'm hoping that very soon we'll be able to greenlight the first Bedouin commercial-scale solar field.
Well, I know after the break we're going to actually really talk about a lot of the work that you've done to expand this work internationally, but I want to ask you, I know that when you completed this solar power field in Israel, being able to supply energy to at least 20,000 homes, you said our work isn't yet done. What do you really mean by that? What is your vision? And then perhaps after the break, we'll talk about how you actually bring that vision to bear.
Look, our dream is really to be able to model for Israel, and then for Israel to model for the world. How do you transform an energy-based economy from burning fossil fuels to being driven by the sun for those places that are blessed with an enormous amount of sun? We'd really like Israel to be a platform to solve these kinds of global challenges. And as we're an enterprising country because we have to stay on our toes, and the Israeli technology and the innovation, A, for ourselves, can hopefully, you know, benefit our society. But we'd love to take the risk out and to model for the rest of the world how we make this transformation, because this is what the world needs. And when no one has done it before on a national or regional basis, there's a lot of fear. And if we could demonstrate the yes, we can-ness of it, that it's really viable and it's economically beneficial, and people can still power their computers and their air conditioners, I think we would have contributed something quite majestic at the right time.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Yosef Abramowitz, president of a Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health and the vision that he has for transforming health for everyone. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Yosef Abramowitz, president of Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health. And Mr. Abramowitz, we're so glad to and just delighted to continue this conversation. I really wanted to move to understand the work that you're doing in the developing world. We know there's a commitment to supplying solar and other renewable energy to many parts of the developing world, especially in Africa. I want to hear from you why it's important to create that renewable infrastructure in the developing world.
So we were building the first solar field in Israel, 2010-2011. And in that year, we had people come from 58 countries to visit us, mostly poor countries, who said, hey, Startup Nation, can you help us? So at that point, we called a timeout and we set up a sister company to do that. And we weren't sure that we'd be able to replicate our success. We did some learning and some experimenting. And then we realized that most of our business, because we're a socially driven business, an impact investment platform, would be in Africa, because 600 million people in Africa without power, and then the couple hundred million who are burning diesel, who are getting electricity from burning dirty and expensive and unhealthy diesel. And when you look at access to food, water, healthcare, and also energy poverty, there's an overlay that's almost absolute. And so we realized we would do the most good in the world if we could actually replicate the kind of big solar fields that we did in Israel, to do it in Africa, and to start putting green energy on the grid. And it's not only that they don't have power, most people, but when they burn kerosene or wood or charcoal or any of this stuff, there are millions of deaths in Africa and injuries from burns and from smoke inhalation that is one of the biggest killers of people in Africa. And so there is a better way, and there is a cheaper way, and there is a cleaner way. And it's time that the world partner with African countries that want to improve not only electricity, but also access to health, getting to a healthier lifestyle.
Well, you know, I know that if you were to start about trying to go into Africa, I'm sure all of us would say, let's pick some of the most difficult countries in the world where poverty is low and political systems are unstable. Is that what you actually did?
So you want to go where you're most needed, and a lot of it is about can you de-risk? And so Rwanda had a genocide, but it was 21 years ago, and it's a society that has pulled itself together. I have a friend who, a philanthropist, who built a youth village for orphans in Rwanda, and she invited us there. Stable government, growing economy, very, very, very little power. And she essentially said, hey, can you build one of those Israeli solar fields on the land of the orphan village and have some of the revenue help pay for the medical costs of the 500 orphans? And the answer is, yes, let's try. You know, no one has succeeded. Let's do that. And so there's the first commercial-scale solar field on sub-Saharan Africa is in Rwanda, the Idaho Shalom Youth Village. And, again, that's pretty stable. But when you do something that is so new and so beneficial, people start knocking on your door. And next door to Rwanda is a country called Burundi, which has been, unfortunately, in the news lately. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. But they said, hey, what you did in Rwanda, can you help our people? And this is a country where 58% of the kids are severely malnourished. And the way we do business is with a lot of social good, a lot of economic and social development. And so we picked it, and we're working hard to realize the benefits there for the people, even as society seems to be falling apart.
Well, that is remarkable and beautiful. How does the funding work? So some of these developing nations, who provides the funding for you to go in there and make such a difference?
We're part of a White House initiative called Power Africa to bring electrification to Africa. We bring 100% financing. It's usually loans from the American government, political risk insurance, and equity from funds and sovereign wealth funds. And what we need is a government guarantee that they're going to buy all the power at a certain price, and we get insurance on that contract as well. It's difficult. There's risk involved, and I think what we're good at is de-risking in tricky places. And so what they do pay for diesel power is 2 to 3 times our price. So we're not looking for any handouts. We're not looking for any subsidies. Nothing fancy. In fact, we're lowering their electric bill. And so it's a different model than in the U.S. economically, because the U.S. has relatively cheap electricity. And in Burundi, for example, the real cost, because the diesel is so unbelievably high and immoral, I think. So we get 100% financing if we get a contract for them to buy the electricity.
Well, you know, you were just recently part of the delegation to the United Nations climate talks in Paris. Can you share with us maybe some unique experience with our listeners or an anecdote from the talks that gave you hope or left you with a new perspective? I think this is an amazing time, and we'd love for you to share an experience.
There were tens of thousands of people who came together to do something that had never been done before, to get a global deal of 196 countries where any one of them could have dissented and ruined the deal. It is a Herculean task. Your listeners in the U.S. can be very proud of the role that the United States played, the President, Secretary Kerry, and the whole team. But it was really an alliance of the Americans, Europeans, and then small island nations who, you know, are drowning under rising seas because of climate change that carried the day. And there are questions about whether or not it was going to happen. And it really does seem like we experienced a miracle. It's obviously all in the follow-up. But what we were looking for, like so many others, what we're calling a market signal, is the world prepared to move from our dependence and economy on fossil fuels towards a much larger share coming from renewables? And by all these nations making commitments, legally binding commitments to themselves and to each other, it's really the first time that we can start envisioning a world with burning less oil, less coal. And there's a divestment movement happening now from oil and coal. And coal shares are down, I think, 75% in the U.S., for example. Oil, too, has its problems. So this is the moment where renewables, from an economic perspective, can scale. But it was so complicated. There's obviously a lot of security. But there was a can-do attitude. And there was a section open to civil society that felt like an activist party. With so many examples of technologies or initiatives that have already worked that can show that different things are possible. And then part of the other session had to do with the trillions of dollars that are being subsidized for the fossil fuel industry, and that was also very enlightening. But there's a sense that, you know, history is in the making, and it's just a great honor to be part of it and to, you know, represent the small but feisty country whose technology and risk management skills can hopefully help the world, the developing world, realize its solar ambitions.
Well, you paint a beautiful vision of the future of nations working together toward this goal. How could our listeners who might be inspired by your activism, your great work, get involved and speak up on behalf of our own country and in our local areas to forward this movement?
We all make decisions every day without thinking about it. And now we have to start thinking about it, each and every one of us. It used to be that none of us recycled, right? We didn't recycle cans or bottles or paper. And now that's become normative, and it's supported by our municipalities. And so that's something that we all do. Look at the cars that we're driving. How many are hybrid, or how many are plug-in hybrids, and how many are all electric? Let's look at our tax benefits for electric cars. In North Carolina, they have not renewed the tax credit for solar fields, for example. So, people care about this, and they need to speak up at the local level and at the state level and at the national level. On the national level, we don't know if the federal tax credits are going to be renewed, which if they're not by Congress, then it can really undermine a lot of U.S.'s leadership and solar jobs in the U.S. And so every decision we make, I charge my cell phone with a solar backpack. It's a small thing, and I'm not saying that's saving the world. You know what? Each decision that we take and incorporate into our lives, there's a sense of empowerment, and there's a sense of being on the right side of history.
We're going to actually say thank you, because on behalf of Your Health listeners, you've really, I think, you're opening up new worlds to solar energy, but you're opening up minds to new ideas of what it means for sustainability. And your mantra of more needs to be done is that mantra for all of us. And it's no wonder that you and your work has been nominated for a Nobel Prize that one day we hope that you get and we can share, and maybe have you back on Your Health to talk with our listeners at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations for that.
Thank you very much. Humanity can win this, and that's really the lesson of Paris. Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Yosef Abramowitz, president of Gigawatt Solar, about solar energy and health. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL. Sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
Christy, if we have a listener who has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, all they have to do is send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to hear from our executive producer, Daniel Lane, who reads us our very first House Call question.
I recently went to see the doctor who gave me amoxicillin for a sinus infection. Some blood work from that visit showed mono, and someone told me the antibiotic could cause a rash. Should I take the antibiotic?
That is a great question. And you're right in that a lot of times that happens more commonly with strep throat, where a doctor might treat with an antibiotic, a penicillin-related antibiotic like amoxicillin for strep throat. And if the patient actually has mono, then there is a good chance that they'll get a rash on their body. And the antibiotic doesn't actually treat mono. Mono is caused by a virus that goes away over time, but there's no antibiotic that actually makes mono better. So it is pretty tricky and confusing.
Well, if you took the antibiotic and got better, we would say
it was good
probably
you took
okay.
It.
But in this case, I think we both probably say probably don't take it. It probably is not a bacterial cause of the sinus infection. We both know that doctors are a little too quick at times to give antibiotics for sinus infections. And so perhaps in this particular case, they got the prescription. They were waiting for the diagnosis. They got the diagnosis back. And a lot of times, Christy and I will probably call you up and say, you know what? Maybe hold off taking that antibiotic because we don't want you to break out in that rash that could be really
make
miserable.
Make it even worse.
And in some cases, could be even life-threatening. So probably not. Great question.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our next house call. Daniel?
I was in the emergency room 2 weeks ago for diarrhea and belly pain. They said I got an infection called Clostridium from my acne medication. Really?
Oh boy, I could tell you're not a happy camper, and I don't blame you at some level.
Well, so what this is a type of infection that can happen related to being on antibiotics. So you have normal bacteria in our guts, in our colon, and when we take antibiotics, sometimes it messes up just the normal bacteria in a way that makes some of this other bacteria, like this Clostridium difficile or C. diff, grow. And it can give you really like watery, like foul, really bad diarrhea. And it can make you really sick. I mean, we have people in the hospital that get so sick, especially older people with this kind of problem.
You know,
and then it can spread through the hospital. It's really contagious too.
And we think of it more commonly with the sicker patients, as Chrissy just said, in the hospital. But in this particular case, you probably, my guess is that you were taking an antibiotic called clindamycin, which is a common antibiotic for acne and other sorts of infections. But we also know, we were taught this early in our medical school education, Chrissy, that's one of the kind of prime culprits that can cause the Clostridium. So, you know, in any antibiotic, increasingly, doctors, we have to tell you about potential side effects, and this antibiotic-associated colitis is a big one that we're really increasingly aware of. So I'm sorry it happened to you. There are other types of antibiotics for acne, but I would encourage you not to be taking antibiotics for the acne. Really look for the non-antibiotic ways of treating the acne with some of the other skin products. Work with your primary care doctor. Work with a dermatologist.
Completely agree. That's good advice. We hope that you're feeling better very soon. And unfortunately, it is an antibiotic that has to be taken to treat the Clostridium difficile. And sometimes it can be stubborn. So we hope that the straightforward medicine will help you feel better.
And take that medication, because if you don't, that Clostridium really could be life-threatening.
That's true.
And you don't want it to develop resistance now to the antibiotic. This is kind of complicated.
It
Maybe our health sciences librarians could put up some really good patient education on
about
our website
C-diff.
About C. diff, about ways of preventing it. Important discussion.
Let's take our last house call, Daniel.
I'm a 48-year-old male, and I'm overweight. My hands and feet have always been pretty susceptible to cold, but last year and now again this year, as the weather is getting colder, they've been getting numb very quickly and very easily. It now also seems like it takes longer for them to get warm and feeling good again. Do you know what might be going on there?
Well, I don't think we can totally blame this on global warming, because this is when it's cold outside, even though we've had lots of warm days around the region and the world.
I know. And, you know, there are several things that could be going on. Certainly that syndrome called Raynaud's, where people get sort of sometimes discoloration of their fingers. And
you say Raynaud's?
Did I say it wrong?
No, I say Raynaud's.
Raynaud's? I say Raynaud's. It's probably Raynaud's. I've got a cold, so whatever I say, just blame it on my cold.
But it is that coldness.
Yeah, exactly. And that is a syndrome where when it is very cold outside, it makes your fingers really painful. They can turn colors. And in your case, it sounds like feeling numb. I mean, there are other things that could be going on, like, you know, think about your thyroid or other things that could make your fingers feel numb. But usually those kinds of things wouldn't happen only in the cold.
Yeah, you know, I don't think this is necessarily related to the weight issues that you have, which would be good for losing weight. It certainly wouldn't, I don't think, hurt the circulation there. And particularly if you have a lot of swelling in your legs and your hands from fluid, that actually will impede kind of this sensation. Are you on some medications for diabetes? And if you had diabetes, could that cause what we call a neuropathy?
Mm-hmm.
These are some other things here. But I think the treatment here, Christy, is?
Is it going to be you singing?
Well, I don't know. It brings a song up.
You want to sing. I can tell.
Well, you know, it makes me think of sunshine.
I can't help you with my cold, man.
We're in the middle of winter. You know what song it makes me think of?
What do you want to sing?
Good Day, Sunshine.
All right, go for it.
We have to say, Good Day, Sunshine.
Boom, boom, boom.
Good Day, Sunshine.
I can't believe you got me to do that.
Good Day, Sunshine.
Okay, all right, that was pretty depressing in sunshine.
But we all need that.
And we do.
And we want to thank you for that house call and listen to all of our house calls today for your health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to you and your health. You can share your own questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at Your Health Radio, or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or just search our health app, Your Health, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Yosef Abramowitz. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health.
with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.